Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jim Flink. India, the world's biggest democracy, just concluded the largest general election in history. More than 537 million votes were cast over the past month, and voters decided to elect a new government. The opposition Bharatiya Janata Party, led by Narendra Modi, won the most votes overall, capturing some 31% of the vote. The Indian Congress Party, led by Rahul Gandhi, came in a distant second, garnering just more than 19% of the vote. Based on the results, the BJP picked up a total of 282 seats in the lower house of parliament, the Lok Sabha. Those seats alone make up 51% of the lower house, making Modi's BJP the first party in 30 years to have an outright majority. Together, the BJP and its coalition partners will control just under 59% of the seats in the Lok Sabha. Major issues in the election campaign included the economy, which has slowed over the past couple of years. Rising food prices and government corruption were also factors, and some have said that the BJP's massive mandate comes largely as the result of voters wanting to punish the incumbent government. But will Modi bring the changes desired? What will India look like under the BJP's rule? Joining us to talk about that today on Global Journalist, Saikat Datta, the national security editor at the Hindustan Times, Javed Anand, a journalist and a civil rights activist who founded the Mumbai-based Sabrang Communications in 1983, and Colleen Braganza, a journalist with the Hindustan Times. And thank you, one and all, for joining us today on Global Journalist. So let's talk a little bit about these numbers, because it is just truly historic. A whopping 814 million voters were eligible to vote. That is as large as the combined voters in the United States, Indonesia, and Brazil, the three biggest democracies after India. 100 million first-time eligible voters going to the polls. That is equal to the size of the populations of UK and Canada. And a million polling stations, 10 million people directly involved, $5 billion spent. This is just massive. So I'd like to ask each one of you your quick takeaways on the election, starting with Saikat.
Well, as far as I can see, this election is a huge shift, not only in terms of a party, but also in terms of ideology. Because for the first time, we have a non-Congress and an extremely right-of-center government coming in, and a party with not just as an alliance, but also as a single party coming in with overwhelming majority, which has never happened in independent India.
Javed, your takeaway.
Well, I would tend to agree with my friend who just spoke. Mr. Modi's coming to power, his party coming to power, is a matter of deep, deep concern for anyone concerned with human rights, because his party is founded on an ideology which, at the best of times, would deliver a majoritarian democracy, and it is known to kind of resort to mobocracy bad at times, very bad, and even ugly at other times, and therefore that's a matter of concern.
And Colleen?
I basically agree with both Saikat and Javed, but my takeaway here is that this election has been historic in the sense that it cut across caste and class to deliver a clear mandate, as you mentioned, for the first time in 30 years. You know, we all thought we had entered the era of coalition governments in 1989, but that's really, I mean, for now, it's come to an end.
The BJP didn't just win this election. It absolutely dominated this election. Let's talk a little bit, and maybe we'll go to you, Javed, because I know that you have some points of view. You have compared Modi's party somewhat to the Reaganomics, the Reagan Revolution that happened in the United States in the 1980s. Explain that maybe a little bit more.
Well, Mr. Modi, one of his kind of big talking points in the election was growth and replication, promise of replicating the Gujarat economic model all over India. It's a model that very closely resembles, to my mind, the Reaganomics that your country is familiar with. It has lots in it going for the corporate world, big business. It has not too much to offer, as the Gujarat experience shows, to the ordinary Indian, or the ordinary Gujarati in the case of Gujarat. Because as any number of studies have shown, high growth in Gujarat, I mean, it is among the states in India which have shown high growth. Gujarat is not unusual that way. It stands in the top five. Has been combined with high levels of hunger. It has been combined with very poor human development index figures to show for. There's something like about 45% malnutrition among children in the age group 0 to 5. So that's the kind of development that he's offering, and that is what, according to many commentators here, amounts to Reaganomics or a Thatcherite model, if you please.
And Saikat, despite the fact that Modi won't be actually sworn into office for a couple of days, he's already sort of indicated that this shift from sort of a large federalist sort of government to more returning to states' rights has already begun. In the Hindustan Times today, you had a report about fewer ministries and more funds to states on Modi's agenda. Explain that just a little bit further.
With the kind of decisive mandate he has, there are two aspects to this. One, the party has also won a majority. But within the party, Mr. Modi, for the first time, has come to dominate the discourse in the party like it has never faced before. So you have to understand that while the party may have had a fairly right but also a centrist position on many of the policies, especially the economic policies, Mr. Modi is far sharper towards the right than his party has ever been. So this will have a huge bearing on the kind of economic policies that will come in, especially because he's also known to be very close to corporate India in a much more overt manner than any other political party. And we have seen this especially when a company like the Tatas were thrown out of another state called West Bengal. Mr. Modi went out of his way to accommodate them in his state, and also ensured that none of the information came out under India's Freedom of Information Act. The second company which he is very closely associated with is a company called Adani. And Adani has had a series of benefits under him. And if these companies continue to grow, and they have actually made a lot of money on the day Mr. Modi was declared the winner, then there will be issues on that front.
You're listening.
As far as security and foreign, I mean, Mr. Modi has made a huge statement by inviting the neighborhood country leaders to his swearing-in ceremony. But he's also supposed to be a hardliner, and that might create a different set of dynamics with Pakistan and China.
You're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jim Flink. Today we are talking about the Indian election and what it means for that country's future. Our guest today, Saikat Datta, the national security editor at the Hindustan Times. Javed Anand, a journalist and civil rights activist who founded the Mumbai-based Sabrang Communications in 1983. And Colleen Braganza, a journalist with the Hindustan Times. Would like to remind you, you can listen to this and other full episodes of Global Journalist on our website. That is globaljournalist.org. For more Global Journalist content, you can also like us on our Facebook page, or you can follow us on Twitter. That is at Global Journ. Colleen, normally when this big a switch in election happens, it is the result of widespread voter dissatisfaction. And it seems as if, despite the fact that he most certainly appeals to the right in India, that a lot of centrist folks also went with Modi. Can you explain a little bit more what that might indicate?
I think what it indicates is that the people were fed up of the current government. It was the drift and arrogance of the Congress UPA was quite evident towards the last two or three years of their reign. There was a lot of, I'd say that a lot of the vote is because of anti-incumbency. There was literally a lot of disgust at the corruption that we have seen during this regime, and also the total arrogance, as was evident in action during, we had a sort of a lot of protests in about 2011-2012. There was this movement called the Anna Hazare movement, then that later turned into the Aam Aadmi movement. This the arrogance of the government at that time, I think, really upset a lot of people who would not normally be with the BJP. So I think it upset a lot of the middle class, a lot of people like me who I'm not normally a BJP fan, but, you know, the reaction, they set the police upon protesters. It was quite disgusting. So I think that combination of factors would have given this, was, I mean, so it would have made this for change for Modi.
Javed, despite the fact that the prior government might have arrogance, there is some concern that Modi's government coming in with such a massive majority, the first time, as we mentioned, that this kind of majority has existed in Indian politics in some three decades, that there might be some arrogance that is represented in some of these new policies with a mandate or at least a perceived mandate. You would argue that mandate doesn't exist, yes?
In fact, just to put it in perspective, who is this man who has been voted into power, who is now going to be Prime Minister in the next few days' time? He is the same person who was the Chief Minister of Gujarat in 2002, that is, would be the American equivalent of being governor of a state. Under his watch, one of the worst incidents of mass crimes happened. Official figures, close to 1,000 people died, most of them Muslims. Unofficial figures say about 2,000 people died. There were gang rapes of women in broad daylight. There were kind of millions of property destroyed, etc., etc. Any number of human rights organizations which did field investigation held the Gujarat state, the Gujarat administration under Modi as complicit in that violence. It has been referred to as a state-sponsored violence targeting Gujarat's Muslims by any number of respected academics across the globe. Now, this is what happened in 2002. The judicial process is still on. One of the survivors of 2002, Zakia Jafri, has filed a petition which is now pending in the Gujarat High Court. It might need to move to the Supreme Court of India if need be, where Mr. Modi is named as the accused number one in the mass violence that took place. Now, this is what was a matter of great concern for a large number of Indians who are otherwise also extremely disenchanted with the kind of politics policies that we have seen on the outgoing UPA government. But the question was, you do not therefore vote for them, but you vote for this man who was kind of denied a US visa until the day of his election results, President Obama. He was boycotted by the entire European community for a whole 10-year period. So a man who is accused of complicity in mass murder, how can we have him as a prime minister of a country is what the concern is all about.
And certainly that is a question, Saikat, with the rise of Hindu nationalism, as many perceive it, and also the anti-Muslim violence from the early 2000s that Javed references. How does a man that is seen so closely linked with that kind of extremism, how does he carry this kind of a majority across the entire country? When you look at the map of the BJP's victories, it is sweeping. So, Saikat, how do you explain that?
The simple answer to that is he changed the narrative. Between 2002, in some ways, was the beginning of Mr. Narendra Modi's election campaign for 2014. In the sense that in 2002, that riot in some ways held him within the party to emerge with certain degree of prominence.
So, Colin, go ahead. Continue, please.
And for a few years, while other leaders continued to dominate, nobody could dismiss Narendra Modi as a future prime minister or at least as a future prominent leader of the BJP. And 2009, as soon as the BJP lost the elections, it was very clear that time had come for a change. And the campaign that Mr. Modi had started at a smaller level from 2002 really gained steam. And they started looking at how to consolidate the Hindu majority vote. And from power presentations of the BJP that I have accessed and seen of the meetings that were held around 2010, their theory was that instead of letting people vote on caste or community or language, let us change the narrative to a message of development, better jobs, better economic prospects, and basically tap into the aspirations of the new voter. And in many ways, even in constituencies in states like Uttar Pradesh, which has about 10 to 20% of the Muslim vote, it turns out that Mr. Modi actually and his party managed to swing those votes. Of course, this went down a little bit in the constituencies which had about 40% Muslim representation. But clearly, he had managed to tap into the youth, first-time voters, and the Hindu majority in ways that had never happened earlier.
Clearly, that economic revival has resonated with voters. Colleen Braganza, I want to ask you to sort of step off and take away your journalist hat for a second. You are Christian in a country where that is roughly about a 3% minority, I believe. Tell me about your personal feelings about Modi and perhaps some of the concerns that Javed referenced earlier.
Okay. At the outset, I'd like to say that what I say now are my personal views and don't necessarily represent the views of my organization.
Of course.
As far as the outcome of this election and my personal feelings about it is, it is one of apprehension. It is acceptance, apprehension tinged with anxious watchfulness. Because, you know, the fact is that Modi is from a grassroots organization called RSS that is modeled on European fascist movements. And they do believe in the civilizational superiority of the Hindus. And anybody else is a second-class citizen. Now, the RSS has considerably helped in this massive sweep that the BJP has. They've got, you know, they've got local units across the country that have spread out and are obviously working towards getting their political wing, that is the BJP, into power. So my fear here is that the problem is that Modi has never done, I mean, let me quote a Nobel laureate here. Amartya Sen had said that the problem is that Mr. Modi has never done enough to make minorities feel safe. And that is a bit alarming for me because he's never showed his remorse for the 2002 riots and the killings that had happened. I am afraid that his silence will be there as a license to proceed with harassment, attacks on minorities. I don't think it's going to be done overtly, but I'm quite certain it will be done subtly. There are a lot of, I would say, fringe elements in society that would be that would see this as a license for them to, you know, go out and maybe harass people. I'm not saying they're going to start killing everybody or whatever, but just harassment, simple harassment of Muslims, of Christians, of other minorities. And let me not just focus on religious minorities, actually. This is also about LGBT communities here. BJP is a culture conservative party. It doesn't look very well at, say, gay couples. There is, in fact, I'll give an example. The Supreme Court is, there's a hearing that's coming up in the Supreme Court on the decriminalization of sex, of gay sex. And the previous government had opposed it, but it was there was an expectation that it would come around and support it in the Supreme Court. And this is a curative petition, which means it's the last option available. Now, with the BJP government coming, that may not happen, which means that people, I mean, gay couples will be harassed by the police as they have been in the past many, many years.
Some have drawn a correlation between the RSS, which you just referenced, and the rise of Hindu nationalism, too, as you mentioned. But you know, when people talk about the rise of neo-Nazism in Europe, clearly everyone understands the gravity of that kind of a reference. Colleen, do you feel like that is an overstatement of the concern?
I don't think it's an overstatement. It's just a resemblance that is quite disturbing. And it doesn't help that Mr. Modi has never come out in public to reject that the worldview of the RSS. See, the RSS is going to come now with the BJP. We've had a BJP government earlier, 1998-99. When Mr. Atal Bihari Vajpayee was the Prime Minister. But, you know, remember, that time it was a coalition government, which means there were other allies in the government who could temper what the government wanted to do. What I find disturbing now is that it is a clear majority. BJP has 282 seats. With its allies, it's in the 340s, I think. It can do a lot. It doesn't help that the opposition, in fact, we've been carrying stories that there's no firm leader of opposition because the Congress is down to 44 seats. So what is the opposition? You have a free hand. Your own party has got a majority. I think I'm not the only one who's worried.
Sure. You're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jim Flink. Today we're talking about the Indian election and what it means for the country's futures. Our guests today are Saikat Datta, the national security editor at the Hindustan Times. Javed Anand is a journalist and a civil rights activist who founded the Mumbai-based Sabrang Communications in 1983. Colleen Braganza is a journalist with the Hindustan Times. And just a reminder again, you can listen to this and other full episodes of Global Journalist on our website, globaljournalist.org. And for more information, you can also like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at Global Journal. So I want to sort of turn this discussion to the possibility of some of the economic hopes of the country and perhaps what we can expect in terms of an agenda immediately as soon as Modi assumes his role as prime minister. And perhaps to that, Javed, you can talk first about what you expect to see in terms of government policy, specifically the economic policies in a country where there is this great disparity between wealth and poverty.
Well, I would think that above all, this is payback time. He's been supported massively by the corporates India, and a lot of the multinational corporates have been kind of very enthusiastically waiting for him to come to power. So he has made the right kind of noises about worrying about and thinking of the poor people of India, etc., etc. But I suspect that his economic policies would be a replication of the Gujarat model, which would be kind of big business oriented.
There are many people who will, to draw on your correlation of Reaganomics and the whole sort of trickle-down theory that went along with it, there are many people that will say that if you point historically to the United States, much of that led to an economic boom such as the country has not seen in the United States. So undoubtedly, Indian voters might believe that that too could happen in India.
Well, the trickle-down did not happen in Gujarat. I mean, they talk about good roads and round-the-clock electricity, but there is still 45% malnutrition in young children. There are, you take any indicator of human development index that is kind of used in terms of human welfare in Gujarat, which has otherwise prospered economically. During his period, if anything, things have got worse, they haven't gotten better. So unless he does some new miracle and something new altogether here, I can't see how this trickle-down will work. And I think the American context and the Indian context are very, very different. We are talking about, you know, you started with numbers in the beginning. We are talking about 1.25 odd billion people. We are talking about perhaps 30% of these people living on less than $1 a day. So how much will trickle down? What kind of time it will take and how long will people kind of live with it is an open question.
Saikat, do you agree with that assessment that in Gujarat, where there has been, I mean, it is looked to as sort of the model of growth that other states in India are looking to and saying, we might like some of that. Clearly, Javed points out that has not benefited all and, in fact, maybe has created greater disparity. Would you agree with that?
Jim, let me try and answer that question by going back to the question that you first posed to Colleen. You asked her about, you know, the fascist or whatever happened in Europe before the Second World War. And if you look at Mr. Modi's position and his party's position and that of the RSS, which is the cadre from which they all come, you see, let us not confuse with the extent with what the fascist or the Nazi party did in Germany. We have to concentrate on the fact that the underlying philosophy, which is, you know, ultra-nationalism and in terms majoritarian rule, etc., those philosophies are in some way similar to what this party has built its cadre on and what happened historically in Europe before the Second World War. So therefore, coming back to what you asked about the economic policies in Gujarat, you see, what the party has always done, and this, there is some historical precedent to it, is they usually go in for the big infrastructure project. Because those are very visible, they're very, very good to sell to the public, and politically they are very, very much, in the short term, politically very easy to show people that they have done a lot of work. What I suspect Mr. Modi will do is he will do similar kinds of stuff very, very quickly in the first few months of his prime ministership. And he will also not discontinue the social welfare policies of the earlier government so that at another level, people continue to get the benefits that they were getting earlier. And this, I am sure, will help him to move on to the next phase of his economic policies, which will be very, very big business friendly.
Let me ask you one more question, all three of you. The relations with Pakistan, what does this election mean for that? And Saikat, maybe we can begin with you.
See, as far as from what I've gathered from Mr. Modi's advisors and the people who are advising him on this, I think he's going to have a much more bigger focus on internal mechanisms rather than looking at foreign policy, in the sense that first he's going to ensure that India's position, whether it is in terms of strategic issues, whether it is in terms of intelligence apparatus or reforms, or whether it is in terms of defense, etc., he will start working towards ensuring that they are much more robust so that he can take a little more hardline stand with Pakistan and China before he really makes his foreign policy much more visible.
Colleen, would you agree with that assessment?
I wouldn't say. I'm not an expert on foreign relations, honestly. So I would just say that he's invited the Prime Minister of Pakistan to his swearing in, which is quite a big gesture for somebody who's been criticizing the previous government for pandering to, say, Pakistan. You know, I remember a famous statement that the previous prime minister, has invited Pakistanis for chicken biryani. He was quite dismissive of him at that time, but he's done it himself now. So it does show that I think he's trying to be magnanimous, which is a good thing, but I don't know where that will lead. I think Saikat will have a better grip on that.
And Javed, maybe the reason that I ask that is with the rise of Hindu nationalism, some might, and the concern about Muslim violence, that might be exacerbated somehow. Your take on that?
I think we have reason to be worried on the score of Indo-Pak relations. His predecessor, Prime Minister from the BJP party, Mr. Atal Bihari Vajpayee, did make a huge gesture when he was the Prime Minister. And in my view, it was a genuine attempt to kind of bring the two countries together. Any number of developments did not make that possible. There's no time to go into that now. Now, Vajpayee was seen by many as a liberal within a hardline kind of the rightist party. Mr. Modi is a very different proposition altogether. So I hope that the invitation to Nawaz Sharif along with other SAARC leaders to attend this thing is not mere posturing, that we are going to see something more positive, but I will have to wait and see.
The implication in Saikat's comments were that India maybe has enough issues within its borders to deal with, that creating any issues with Pakistan again might not be to anyone's benefit. Is that the way that you would take that?
Well, that's a far more complicated question. You know, we all have a certain perception of Mr. Modi, but I'm not so sure how much of that will still hold, because his position in India and its politics has changed dramatically. So you may actually see a very different Mr. Modi than what we have seen earlier, and I wouldn't like to dismiss that possibility. That said, Pakistan is also a very different, difficult country to deal with. I mean, let us accept that the civilian government really doesn't rule Pakistan, and as far as bilateral relations with India, China, and the United States is concerned, it's the Pakistan army which plays a bigger role. So there, unless the Pakistani military comes on board, which is very, very unlikely, I don't see what Mr. Modi or anybody else can do about this right now.
And that will have to be the final word. That's all for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Our thanks to our guests today, Saikat Datta, Javed Anand, and Colleen Braganza. Our executive producer is Casey Morell. Our lead producer is Zahra Rasool, with assistance from Cameron Dodd. Travis McMillan from the Reynolds Journalism Institute is our technical director, Pat Akers of KBIA, our audio engineer. Join us again for another edition of Global Journalist next week. I'm Jim Flink.